Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of You're Wrong with me, David Harsanyi, and Molly Hemingway. Molly, how are you?
Great to be here with you. You said you were up late last night. Why were you up late?
I was going to mention that. That was going to be my intro. Have you ever watched Graham Norton show highlights on YouTube?
No.
So this is a talk show in England, in Britain. Actually, he's Irish. And he has celebrities on, huge celebrities, the biggest celebrities, but also British celebrities. And they just sit on a couch and talk. And it is quite funny. And it is addictive. There are like a million of these on YouTube. And I could not stop watching it. So I was up really late watching these. I'm like, oh, just one more. And they're each like a half hour.
At least you were up late for a really good reason. Also, I was wondering, you seem kind of old man-ish in your sleep habits. So I'm wondering, what is late? Was that 9 p.m.?
Where do you get off saying that? You don't even know when I go to sleep. No, it's more like 1 o'clock.
Oh, wow. Remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, usually I'll probably go to sleep at 12 or like 11:30.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So
okay.
You have old womanish women? And when do you go to sleep?
No, I think everyone actually has their own sleep needs. And I don't know why, but I think I need less sleep than most people. And I frequently go to bed, I'd say in the 1 to 3 a.m. range.
Yeah, I can't do that anymore. I am an old man. Yeah. But I have trouble sleeping. I think we went through this one time. So I'm happy for the sleep I can get. But I don't think the Graham Norton show is worth staying up till 1. Like, there are things that are worthwhile to give up sleep for. And I don't think this is one of them. Though you should watch this show. It is pretty funny.
I like how some nights I'm like, I really need to get a good night's sleep. I really need to get to bed. And then like 3 hours later, I'm burrowing into some like topic that I don't need to know about, you know, some ancient culture that I hadn't heard of before. And I'm like reading about the interesting things about its language or something. And I'm like, how did this happen?
What about those Assyrians? Like, if that comes up at 1, that'll be a 2-hour dive into the Wikipedia page, maybe. It's funny because I was on a long drive with my wife recently, and I'm like, we should listen to this. This is super exciting. It's one of my favorite books, and it's about Carthage. So she was really nice for like an hour, and then she was like, really, I can't anymore with this. But anyway.
I try to end all my speeches, media, delenda, est, and like half the people have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I forget. Was that Cato the old elder? Mm-hmm. The younger, the elder.
Carthage must be destroyed.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's move on to some political topics. So there was an election last night, and Herschel Walker lost to Reverend Warnock. And what, you know, I think we probably both expected it, right? So there's no big surprise there.
I will say I'm actually somewhat surprised by how close it was. I so expected Warnock to win. The fact that Herschel was keeping it close was really interesting to me.
Yeah, it was closer than I thought it was too. I just thought it would be a blowout, mostly because I wasn't paying attention. And if I'm not paying attention, who could really care? But one interesting note on this was that after in his speech, victory speech, Warnock mentioned that voter suppression was still alive and well in Georgia, which just blew my mind, considering you had two African-American candidates in a state with a large Black population, and you had historic, I hate to call mail vote turnout, but you had historic turnout among Blacks, but also among just everyone. And it hit me that we're never going to get over this stuff because it's just so embedded. I mean, I think voter suppression is a complete myth. I don't think it exists at all. I want to interview one person in Georgia who couldn't vote, who was, you know, suppressed in that way. I don't think that person exists. And if they do, I would love for someone to send them to me. But it's just so embedded in their rhetoric, in their thinking, this victimhood, meaning Democrats, that I don't know how we get over it, I guess.
Well, I do think there are some interesting issues here. Democrats use the rhetoric of voter suppression, as a way to make sure that their march to basically destroy how we do elections is able to continue. You might remember that when the legislature of Georgia put some really modest, mild election security controls in place after they broke open everything for COVID, everyone from President Biden on down claimed that this was Jim Crow 2.0, that if you in any way cared about even like a tiny little completely inadequate check on security of ballots, that you were trying to suppress voters. And they were unable to keep Georgia, despite like really massive intervention, they were unable to keep Georgia from passing these too mild and too modest reforms. But it did probably keep a lot of other states from passing them. If you know that if you work to have any integrity of your election, any security of your election, that Coca-Cola and Major League Baseball might punish you to the tune of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, you might be less likely to care about improving the integrity of your elections. So there is kind of a voter suppression going on. It's going on in exactly the opposite effort, because when you allow or make it possible to have less secure voting, that does in fact disenfranchise legal voters. And when you also make it so that like it just becomes a ballot harvesting operation, which, by the way, is actually a big part of what Georgia does, then you also disenfranchise an electorate. We used to care about for hundreds of years, we cared about whether voters were informed and able to make decisions about the future of their county or state or country. And now we just care about ballot harvesting operations. We don't care if you're informed. We don't care if you know there's an election, who the candidates are. All we care about is, do you have a name that can be tied to a ballot that we can get into a ballot box? And this is a form of suppression of the electorate, because it's not just about whether you have a pulse, but whether you care about like and understand things about the country, whether you care enough to like get out there and vote on election day, that no longer matters. So Raphael Warnock is actually somewhat right that election issues and voter suppression played a role in his victory, but in exactly the wrong way that he would like to indicate.
Yeah, I think far too many people vote in the sense that I think they have a civic duty not to vote if they are ignorant of issues. Obviously, people don't like when I say that. I don't want to stop people from voting, though I would like to make it more a little more difficult as far as mail-in ballots and stuff like that. But also, I think there's another aspect to this. If we had a media that actually worked, did its job, there would be a big discussion right now about all the rhetoric that was used by Biden, the Jim Crow 2.0 stuff, and the bill they wanted to pass that would have overturned the about hundreds of election laws that were voted on by people, that it was all just this this hyperbolic nonsense, basically. And there's no discussion on that. They get to scaremonger as much as they want, and then we just move on like nothing happened when it doesn't come true, which is constantly happening on almost every issue, from net neutrality to voting rights, you know, and stuff like that. So it really is disheartening. Actually, well, I'm not disheartened anymore. I want and hope that every media institution is destroyed. Like, I've never been happy when people get fired, even people I dislike. It always bothers me. I never go out there. There's no Schadenfreude there for me. But I think for the good of the country, these institutions must die somehow, and we need real journalists to emerge. And I think that project's going to be decades long. Sorry.
Go on. Yeah, well, if you do hate how corporate media are destroying the country, the last week was pretty rough for them. They had a lot of layoffs. They had a lot of closures. Things do not seem to be going as well for them.
Yeah, but the wrong people are being punished, in the sense that the most, not always, but the loudest, most partisan voices, and I don't even mind the partisanship as much as I mind the dishonesty of the coverage and the activism of the coverage, those people rarely get punished. They get rewarded. It's real, you know, in the end, when firings happen, it's going to be the journalist who doesn't have the, you know, million followers on Twitter and all that, who gets fired. So I don't know. The whole thing seems upside down to me.
You know, if I can go off on a tangent really quickly, I do
That's
find
what
it
we do.
interesting these midterm elections where to just take a step back and acknowledge that, for lack of a better term, the establishment actually did all right. And you look at this particularly through the prism of the Republican Party, there's a bit of a civil war brewing. I think it goes back a long time, but maybe you look at the Tea Party, the rise of the Tea Party, the effort by Mitch McConnell and other establishment figures to squash the Tea Party, how that did seem actually kind of successful. He had a lot of wins in 2014. He was very open about his desire to destroy the conservative populist movement that was based on constitutional principles. And yet it also frustrated Republican voters so much. They were so frustrated with the Republican Party that when Donald Trump comes along, they kind of run to him because they're so sick to death of their own establishment. So he confounds everybody, or like surprises everybody, by winning in 2016. And that's when the establishment really goes like, oh, we got like a big problem. They obviously undermine him a lot during his administration. Even Republicans are helping along with the Russia collusion hoax. The Senate GOP totally helps that hoax along. They do nothing to stop it. They do nothing rhetorically to stop it, nothing politically to stop it. You know, they only do what they're supposed to do on the first impeachment hoax or the second impeachment, just because they know their voters will kill them if they don't do the right thing. But they really hope that this midterm they will be able to kind of get rid of that conservative populism. So everyone's playing in the primary, and there was supposed to be some massive establishment victories in the primary, but the voters are just not going back there. So this more conservative populist wing gets a lot of victories, and the establishment is very focused on not letting those people win. And they do it through all sorts of game playing with money or rhetoric or like not having a policy agenda. And I think they think they did pretty well. I think they look at they survey the land and they think, well, we're really doing a good job. We're trying to make this conservative populism toxic so we can move past it. And I think they could not be more wrong about that. And I think a great example of how wrong they are is in the success of Ron DeSantis. He, you know, narrowly wins in Florida 4 years ago, wins in a landslide this year. He is very popular with the voter. He is not an establishment figure. He's not establishment in his foreign policy, in his approach to domestic policy, his willingness to take on corporations. He's like firmly a product of I mean, Trump is the reason why he was able to win the nomination 4 years ago. He's firmly in that sort of Trump wing of the Republican Party, and he's also the future. But because the establishment just frankly kind of did so well in these midterms, this civil war is going to continue, and it's going to be hot. It's going to be like heating up, and it's not going away. And I think, you know, all of Washington, D.C. thinks they won. They're like, we did it. We got rid of Trumpism and Trump. And I don't think they did. And I don't think they realize how messy this could get if they continue to resist where their voters are.
Yeah, I guess I just don't see it that way. I don't see it that way at all. I think that everyone claims DeSantis as their own, but I don't, and I'm not saying that Trump didn't help him win an election, but I don't think he's a man of Trumpism, whatever
Are
that
you
exactly
high
means.
right now?
I
Are you
just
high?
don't. I've wrote a whole column about this. I just simply don't see it that way. People do not move to Florida because Ron DeSantis or love Florida or change or make that a red state because he's acting like Trump. They do it because they're a low t they do it for all the reasons that have traditionally been conservative: low regulatory environment, low taxes, freedom,
But you're
school
always
choice
complaining
down
that
there.
he's high. You're the one complaining that he's a like a conservative populist, that he's okay with telling corporations what they can and can't do. You're the one who's saying the opposite of that.
I don't understand that. So you're saying DeSantis tells corporations what to do?
Do you not think he did that?
I just don't believe it's, first of all, I wanted to take a quick step back. I don't think it's a binary choice between Trumpist populist economics and so on and the establishment. There's a third way. Being anti-cronyism should have been part of the Republican message from the beginning. That doesn't mean that you have to adopt what these a lot of these national conservatives do, where they just want a different kind of welfare state. I don't think DeSantis wants that kind of policy in America. And I'm not saying he's exactly like an establishment figure at all. I don't believe that's true. But DeSantis was, you know, went after the Tea Party groups when he first ran for Congress, I believe, and their endorsements as well. I don't think that he's a Trumpist in that way. I think his attitude is more like Trump, but I don't think his policies are very populist in that way. I don't know. That's just how I see it.
It just occurred to me that I don't know what people mean when they say Trumpist. Like I hear it as a slur, and some people mean willingness to fight the media. Some people mean willingness to take on big tech. Some people mean, things I don't like. Like everyone has a different definition for what's Trumpist or Trumpy or Trump related.
That is true.
It would probably help us to define what we mean by like in the Trump wing of the party.
I am not reflexively anti-Trumpist as far as voters go. I understand their inclinations. I think I understand their grievances and all that. When I say it, I'm talking about first of all, I'm talking about a lot of the things that Trump does that I don't like saying that we should ignore the Constitution, worrying about what happened in 2020 constantly rather than looking for things like that, but also just economic policy and the way that he approaches a lot of domestic policy as a sort of a big government conservative. So when I read, I'll give you a perfect example. There was a column in Compact Magazine by Josh Hawley with just a preposterous leftist economic class obsessed view of America that says if we give welfare to unions like the rail union, then people will start going back to church and we're going to have strong communities. He sounds like a Marxist. He just goes to church. That's the only difference between him and a Marxist that I can see. So anyway, that's the kind of person that I'd want no part of. DeSantis doesn't act that way. DeSantis doesn't talk about class. DeSantis tries to have an inclusive message that transcends that sort of thing. So anyway, that's just how I see that debate. I just don't think it's a binary choice between, first of all, there's always going to be an establishment. Someone has to run things, and there's always going to be a populist message within any political movement. I also concede, obviously, that in Ohio, you need different kind of candidates than you need in Arizona and Nevada and Georgia. So,
Nevada.
So how I say it is like a New York way of saying it, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's anyway. So much there, what you just said. So I actually,
everything I just said, didn't
well,
you?
I'm like the thing I always preach is about how a unified Republican Party is a strong Republican Party. And so I actually agree with a lot of what you're saying. There are elements of Ron DeSantis. I mean, Ron DeSantis would not be loved by the people if he weren't anti-DC establishment. And he really is not. I mean, he worked in DC as a member of the House for years and did not make a lot of friends here. And it's one of those things that's interesting, like how that's interpreted by the DC establishment. They don't like him very much. They're pretending to like him right now because they think he's the most effective way to get rid of Donald Trump, their nemesis. I do think that people who hate the establishment should not necessarily blame Ron DeSantis for the love he's receiving from the establishment. He's smart enough to understand what's going on there. Or I believe he's smart enough to understand what's going on there. And the moment that they would be able to get Trump out in favor of DeSantis, they would turn on DeSantis in favor of their preferred candidates like Nikki Haley or Mike Pompeo type. And those are people who worked for Trump, but are not what we mean by, the Trump wing of the party. I actually don't like even talking about Trump so much because I think it obscures the deeper and more longstanding and more the issues that are going to remain long after Trump is gone, which are that there is this disconnect between the people running the Republican Party, what their aims and goals are, and what their voters have expected of them. And voters are livid. So, like, I'm sure they're happy with that the establishment is happy with how things went in the midterms, the Republican establishment. Their voters are sick to death of the failure theater, of how much money they take to fail, of how little they care about winning, of how they have no cohesive policy message, how they don't fight Democrats. And this is brewing, and it's going to continue to brew. And there will be a lot of people within DC who misread the moment and who think that just because everyone in so-called conservative media is in lockstep on, blaming anyone but themselves for what happened or blaming only the orange man, they think that that message is going to resonate with people. I don't actually think it's resonating with people. I think people are really angry at how little Republicans accomplish when they're in power, when they're out of power, relative to what they see Democrats able to do.
I have a few things to say on that, if I can remember. They're disconnected. One would be that you touched on something I think is important, is competency. I think when you look at the most successful Republicans right now, they're Youngkin, Kemp, and DeSantis. They're all pretty competent at their jobs. I think we underestimate the incompetent establishment. But Trump is also sort of incompetent, obviously, in my view. He didn't.
It's weird. I would say no president has accomplished as much as Donald Trump did. So I'm not sure where you're getting, I don't know if it was competence or just willingness to push forward on an agenda. Did he meet universal hostility that affected the success? Yeah, but he seemed to still overcome it. There's a difference between what he accomplishes in office and what he's doing out of office, which I think is much less impressive.
All right. Well, I am not even going to go down that route with arguing with you about the accomplishments right now. That is a big topic. I think that's
you just long. Said you said establishment is all about the traditional Republican thing is about deregulation. No Republican president holds a candle to what Donald Trump did by obsessively focusing on deregulation.
I don't think that I said that. I said that's part of it, not the most. But yeah, I agree. I'm not saying Donald Trump didn't accomplish things. His Middle East policy was excellent. The deregulation was excellent. His judges were excellent.
If you like peace and prosperity, he was very competent.
Okay. I'll concede that for the sake of argument.
If you like tweets
to move on and just say
funny.
That I think that many Trump fans misread the moment of 2016 as well, where a lot of Americans wanted a candidate who fought the media, who fought back, who wasn't pushed around, who was tough and all that. But that doesn't mean that there was this widespread acceptance of what the intellectual wing of the, of the Trumpist movement, let's just say, believes that now Republicans wanted big government, that we wanted a welfare state, that we're pro-union, that we were, all these things. That's a misreading of the situation as well, as we've seen, because candidates, there have been three elections now where a lot of Trump candidates don't win. I'm not saying that they don't win everywhere, but they definitely have struggled just as much as establishment candidates before them.
So I think, though, that this also you have to put into this mix. And I totally agree with you. People overread everything when there's a complicated mixture. But what we have seen happen in the establishment, and particularly in the media establishment, since 2016 has really opened a lot of people's eyes to how much desire there is of establishment people to stay in control. And there are people like you and me who actually read politics daily and enjoy it. And there are, that's a pretty small percentage of the country, if we're being honest. Some of those people are on the right. Some of those people are on the left. There is this vast middle ground of the country that is very much persuaded by corporate media messaging. And we can point to polls showing that corporate media have lost respect. And that's true. But they still control a lot of narratives. They still control what a lot of just normal people think and what they think is acceptable and what they think is tolerable. And what media did with their just lies, propaganda, suppression of information from 2016 to the present is just horrific. It's meaningful. And there are a lot of people who just kind of go along with that. And I even mean in that like Republican leadership. So what the challenge is that a lot of Republican voters have had their eyes opened to how big of a threat corporate media are to the future of the country. And they look at their Republican senators, almost without exception. They look at their Republican House members or their governors, and they just see a bunch of impotent, weak men and women, I guess, who just like wouldn't know how to have a fight and win a fight if their life depended on it. And it is increasing their frustration.
I think in some, I agree with that. But I think in some sense, it's a manifestation of the, honestly, the intellectual, the ideological diversity of the Republican Party is a little, it's a little more diverse than I think Democrats are. And it's a little more difficult for them to get on the same page sometimes with policy. But aside from that, I just wanted to say another thing that Trump did that was just by his very nature happened, and the hatred that there is from, he exposed the rot in our universities, in our media establishment, in our law, in, you know, our federal law enforcement, you know, establishment, in our, you know, among our expert class, among our foreign policy class, you know, like that's for sure. I mean, I have always been skeptical about all of that, all those institutions. And even I am constantly like shocked at how dumb for, you know, people are who work in those institutions once they get out or when I see them on Twitter. So that is a big problem that the Trump era has exposed. Again, I don't know how we fix that. But
so since we have to keep moving here, but speaking
don't have
of
to do deep, anything. Yeah, but go on.
Deep state things. Did you see the story about James Baker being let go from Twitter and why?
Yeah, I was kind of, I just, when I wrote a, like a rant on the general topic of Elon Musk and the Twitter files, and I just assumed he had been fired before. Like, I didn't know he was still at the company.
Like last spring, people brought to Elon Musk's attention that James Baker was working at Twitter, and he said, this is disconcerting. And for people who don't know, James Baker was the FBI general counsel. He was intricately involved in the Russia collusion hoax. He is really close friends with David Corn, who was one of the people who was involved in the Russia collusion hoax at Mother Jones. He resigned as people were bearing down in a leak investigation about leaks to reporters about the Russia collusion hoax that the FBI helped run. He was involved in the Sussman issue. So Michael Sussman, a DNC lawyer or Democrat lawyer, I should say, worked with James Baker to put in parts of the Russia collusion hoax into the FBI. So he's like really involved. It's kind of like I saw someone say he's the Forrest Gump of bad, corrupt government official dumb. And he then gets hired as a reward for his attack on the country by Twitter. And he's like deputy general counsel there. He's a really not good guy to have if you wanted a company to be trustworthy. And this weekend, Musk starts releasing through reporting stories about how Twitter suppressed the Hunter Biden story and otherwise meddled in the 2020 election. And it came out Friday. It was really interesting to see how these people were involved in a coordinated campaign to suppress news and information and keep it from the American people. And yesterday news broke that while Musk had demanded that these pieces of information be released to reporters, that James Baker had been meddling in that inappropriately and had been let go from Twitter.
Yeah, which means that what you saw, it was probably much worse, and we haven't seen some emails that
well,
implicate
I would just
him,
say,
probably.
Yeah, given that he works at the FBI, it's probably a lot about how federal government officials or other deep state actors were colluding with Twitter execs to help Democrats.
And the thing is, and I've mentioned this elsewhere, but I don't believe that we need to see an email of explicit demands of collusion, it can be a concerted effort without having to speak to someone when you're doing it, right? You can, you know what to say when you see those 51 former intelligence officials saying that the Hunter Biden laptop is like classic Russian disinfo op. You know what to do after that. That's your excuse. And the funny thing is that he was involved in this, and the emails still implicate him as the person who kind of overrode the concerns of other officials who were like, what are we doing here? This is ridiculous. I mean, there are at least two Twitter officials who are like, this excuse is really flimsy, we you know, to ban this story. And again, I wanted to mention another thing. It wasn't about, it was never about ensuring that people wouldn't see the story. They knew that people would hear about it. It was about undermining the reporting, smearing the reporters, smearing the New York Post, and making it so that no one would trust the story. That was the purpose of all this. It wasn't like, oh, people aren't going to see it now. Everyone would just go to Post and see it if they wanted to. It was about making sure that a bunch of people wouldn't believe it.
And this had real consequences. This was mentioned in a debate as if it were Russian disinformation. President Biden has not been held to account for his own false claim that things that he knew were true were in fact Russian disinformation, like that's what he was saying. And, you know, we are in a proxy war with Russia, and having the people that we're at war with know that our current president lied about them to protect his son, it's probably like, put you in a bad bargaining position for different things. It has global consequences, this type of disinformation campaign about disinformation.
There's a good piece, in the Wall Street Journal by James Freeman, where he goes through at the time of the debates when this first came up, what not just Joe Biden said, but what a bunch of reporters, what Chuck Todd said, you know, about Russian disinformation and all of that, which we're going to find out if the, and it seems to me, I have to follow this up, but I saw someone writing about it, that the FBI had the laptop already at this point. So they knew
that. David, okay, Margo Cleveland, I think, might have been one of the first people to break that news. Yeah, they'd had it for years, I think.
But so they already knew that wasn't the case. And Joe Biden still went on TV and said that, you know, that it was Russian.
And let's even think about this. You saw that in this really interesting lawsuit from the Attorney General of Missouri and the Attorney General of Louisiana, they got testimony from a San Francisco FBI official saying that they were meeting with big tech executives, including Yoel Roth of Twitter and I think Mark Siegel or something like that of Facebook, and that they were warning them. Oh no, they admitted that they were meeting with these people to kind of talk to them about censorship. And then Yoel Roth said, I think this was the person who said that he had been specifically warned about Russian disinformation considering Hunter Biden personal information. I think that confirms not just that we didn't already know this, that the FBI had the laptop, but they knew it was going to come out, and they were trying to help their buddy Hunter from being, and their buddy Joe Biden from having any, you know, discussion of the very real news and information about the Biden family business and its corruption.
And it should always be stressed, this is not about Hunter Biden. It's about Joe Biden. It's about Hunter Biden in the sense that he used his dad, who was the vice president and a presidential candidate, to make a lot of money. But it's about, did Joe Biden also benefit from this money? It's a completely legitimate question.
And
there are on the record witnesses who say yes, which is more than anyone had for Russia collusion hysteria.
On the record, with their name, on video, people saying they worked with Joe Biden, that he was intimately involved, contrary to what he had publicly stated. And it's also not about Hunter Biden in the sense that it's not just about Hunter Biden. There are many members of the Biden family who are involved in the Biden family business, which is to take money from people who are willing to give you money because of your close proximity to Joe Biden. Sometimes that's foreign oligarchs or corrupt foreign governments. Sometimes that's domestic people who want to have a good in with a powerful figure. That journalists didn't cover this, much less run it to ground, is just, you know, inexcusable, but typical.
And that's a great point. It is a legitimate story by any standard. First of all, the president, now we know, lied to the American people on numerous occasions about his knowledge of his son's business. That's, we know that's a fact now from other sources and this. And the excuse, I saw, I had this funny interaction on Twitter. I saw Washington Post journalists saying that they couldn't run with the story because they hadn't independently verified all the facts. This is, so I asked one of them, is it the habit of the Washington Post to share their data and their sources with other newspapers? And of course, no. And Philip Bump got back to me and called me like, what he said, like that I don't understand journalism. Obviously, it's clear that I don't have any journalistic knowledge. There are literally hundreds of examples of he and others at the Washington Post sharing scoops from other outlets and simply crediting those reporters. We do it all the time. I did it 20 some odd years ago when I started, and I do it today, and that is normal practice.
Can I tell you
this
my favorite?
In an insane standard that they create out of whole cloth to try to make excuses and justifications for not covering a major story right before an election.
My favorite Philip Bump story, which I wrote about early on at the Federalist, is that he doesn't know how babies are made. And I love that about him because he's a grown man and he has no idea how babies are made. And I learned this because Marco Rubio was talking about science denial, like in 2014 or 15 or something. And he was talking about how people deny the reality that life begins at conception, which is, you know, it's a tautology. It's just like, that's how it happens. You conceive a new life. And Philip Bump was like, actually, I don't think that's totally right. And he quoted some people like pro-abortionists who are trying to deny the reality that an individual human life begins at conception. And he never corrected his piece, even though like, you know, it's just basic biology that life begins at conception. And so he never corrected it. It's still uncorrected to this day. He's not like the brightest bulb in the chandelier, but he is a very big Democrat activist. He was a union activist and he was a Democrat activist and he has become, you know, that's what he's paid for. And so it's not surprising that he would run cover for his allies in the Democrat Party who look so bad for what they did and how they were able to collude with big tech executives to help their politicians.
Yeah, I don't mind that people have their opinions and that they're, I think his stuff's on the edit page or whatever. I mean, I you know, you can have an opinion, you can say what you like, but there are some basic journalistic principles that we should all be following or none of this really works. An activist, we have an ideological outlook. We even have a political outlook and we write about it. But we, you know, once you start inventing new rules for half the people or you're lying or you're ignoring stories, then you just have no principles. And there's this whole there's a subgenre on the Washington Post edit page where they have activists pretending to be reporters like Rex Sargent and people like that. That is the most annoying, like this veneer of seriousness where Greg Sargent goes out and finds someone to say what he wants to say and pretends he's not some kind of, you know, that this person he's talking to is an expert and not just kind of partisan. It's really dishonest. I don't care that much, but it does makes me laugh.
And back to your main point, you didn't need the New York Post story to cover the Hunter Biden or Biden family business corruption. We already had publicly available documents. By the way, there was a Senate report based exclusively on government documents about the Biden family business and its corruption. It broke news. It was from Senator Ron Johnson and I think Senator Chuck Grassley. They were based on Treasury documents and other government documents that they were able to obtain that talked about how the Biden family business was taking money from various corrupt oligarchs. You didn't need the New York Post story. I believe Philip Bump and other activists at the Washington Post threw water on this government report.
I should say, they said they couldn't write about it, but they did. All these places wrote about how bad the story was. They wrote about how there was a New York Times story about how the Post newsroom didn't, you know, people within the Post room didn't, and all these stories about how terrible the Post Hunter Biden scoop was.
Oh, and they did that?
Relied on anonymous sources, which is the opposite of what the Post did. The Post had far more substantiation of the facts on this story than the people who wrote about the story did about how the story was terrible. Do you know what I'm saying? It's just completely ridiculous.
And also, we're talking about a publication that won won Pulitzer Prizes for regurgitating whatever anonymous corrupt intel officials told them to write about Russia collusion. So these people don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to, oh, we wouldn't do anything without independent verification. They won Pulitzers for the Russia collusion hoax that wasn't real. They clearly, by definition, were willing to run stories without confirmation of anything related to them.
I just want to go off on journalism a little more. Journalism is not a meritocracy anymore at all. The best writers do not get the best jobs. The best reporters do not get the best jobs. The people who kiss butt the most and say the things that those in charge and their sources in higher ups in government want them to say. And that's the problem of journalism. You are rewarded for being a partisan. You are never rewarded for good reporting. And I just want to say there is very little reporting going on. The best journalists do not report. They are perched in these high positions with huge audiences, and government officials come to them and give them stuff. They're not going and looking at microfiche and figuring things out. It's not like Watergate. They're not going into, you know, parking garages underground and meeting with sources. All of that is a myth. They do nothing. They're just given stuff, and they just say what people tell them to say. And, you know, it's a corrupt, I don't mean in the sense of illegal, but it's just a corrupt profession. And I keep saying that every podcast, like every
true story that yesterday someone told Sean Davis how frustrating it was that we at the Federalist require confirmation of various theories that, you know, sources have. And it was meant in jest, but it was also kind of a reminder that a lot of people do just run with whatever gossip, innuendo, or outlandish claim that an anonymous source gives them, and they get into a lot of trouble that way. We can't afford to get in any trouble, so we check everything out, but makes it harder to run wild.
Again, I've never been at the Washington Post or New York Times, but I was at a decently sized newspaper. And if someone called me with a story that was perfect, I always was skeptical. Can you imagine you're a reporter at the Washington Post and someone says, hey, you know, the president is actually a spy for Russia. And you're like, oh, yeah, that sounds completely reasonable and something I'm going to move forward on. I mean, write story after story relying on a single sort anonymous source that's obviously politically motivated. Anyway, I did want to say one more thing about journalism, just a quick topic. Did you see that AP style book, you know, which used to be an incredibly important source for journalists, for me? I mean, I would go there to look for the precise words and language and style of writing when I worked in news reporting, says that you can no longer say late term abortion in AP style.
Yeah, I saw that. And they said the reason why you can't say late term abortion, it was an absurd reason, because that would mean that it took place from 41 weeks to 41 weeks and 6 days, which is absurd. And therefore, you should say killing the baby late in its, gestational life or something.
Yeah.
No.
Exactly.
Oh, no, they didn't say that. They said late in pregnancy abortion.
Right. So late term abortion has been a term used for a long time. And in the 90s, it was regularly used by media, and because it's very specific and people understand what it means and what it entails as a surgical procedure that kills a human life, so that they want to use it. But I don't know if people realize that the style book, and this happened, I believe, earlier this year, changed the usage of, you're not supposed to say anti-abortion or pro-life. You're supposed to say a person who is for abortion rights or a person who is against abortion rights, which is a complete euphemistic way of speaking about a procedure. Yeah,
that was not earlier this year. That was a long time ago. This is actually why I got into media criticism. Was I saw
Is that an official change at the time? In its style book?
Let me just say, I don't remember when the change you refer to happened, but it's not this okay. year. It was a long time ago. But I remember early on reading the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post, and they would refer to pro-choice and anti-abortion people. They changed it sometime to like pro-abortion rights or anti-abortion rights. Of course, this is an ontological issue, right? Do you have a right to take a human life or not? So it was already like embedded into the term were some assumptions that favored those who do support the killing of unborn children. Anyway, it is why I got interested in media criticism, was because I saw how bad things were. David Shaw is this, I think, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who worked at the Los Angeles Times and wrote this amazing four-part series in 1990 about abortion and how it's covered by corporate media. And he seemed to be someone who himself supported abortion, but he wrote about how the bias is so deeply ingrained in everything that journalists do. They use terminology that favors their allies who support killing of unborn children. They use terminology that disfavors the people on the other political side. The story selection is designed to pull heartstrings in favor of their preferred advocate. They use weasel words and scare quotes to describe the arguments of other people who disagree with them. They marginalize those voices of people who disagree with him. And he did this like, it's actually amazing that the Los Angeles Times published it, and you can still find it online. It's comprehensive. And it was in 1990, so like 17 years after Roe v. Wade. And let's just say things have gotten dramatically worse since then.
David Shaw wrote The Pleasure Police, which is an excellent book on nanny state stuff and against political correctness. I believe it's the same guy. Yeah, later in the 90s. But there are, you know, so anyway, my point is when you have to rely on, it says something about your position when you have a need to rely on euphemisms. If you didn't, if it was something that was innocent and just healthcare, you wouldn't need the euphemisms. But they, you know, but all our all reporting is larded up with euphemisms. And the worst one, I was thinking about this morning, is gender affirming care, which is the most Orwellian euphemism in existence because it does the opposite of what it says. So gender affirming therapy is when you tell a little girl that she can be a little boy, but conversion therapy is when you tell a little girl that she's a little girl. It's the exact opposite, right, of what it means. And right. They do this constantly, like social safety net is, you know, for welfare and on and on. I have a list. Maybe one day I'll write a column of these, but I mean, there's nothing new here. Reforms, you know, is when Democrats want to change something, but like breaking norms when Republicans.
I just
want to
say on the dystopic euphemism of gender affirming care, it's particularly bad when you consider what it is referring to. It's talking about cutting off healthy breast tissue of underage girls, or talking about cutting off the healthy male genitalia of little boys. It's mutilation. It's an abomination. I actually think people who are pushing this should be in jail. It's kind of crazy to me that people are like upset about it, but they're not upset about it at the level that they should be upset about it. It was revealed today, or I read today, that American Girls puts out these books, which are actually, they used to not be bad. They're like books that help girls understand what puberty is going to be like. And they're for different age groups. And there was a report in the Daily Mail that the one for the girls aged 3 through 12 does encourage this gender ideology that teaches girls to, you know, view their bodies as perhaps bad and not in needing change and needing hormones or surgical interventions. And it's, you know, this is a company that interacts directly with young girls in the midst of a social contagion that involves lifelong mutilation of these girls' bodies. And any parent who cares, or grandparent or uncle or aunt, or anyone who cares about children, should do whatever it takes to remove anything from that company, you know, from their children's midst, and keep it away, because this is, you know, you've I'm sure seen all of these videos, these heartbreaking videos of young women who are regretting the mutilation that grown adults allowed them to undergo. And how it has permanently messed up their bodies and perhaps affected their ability to have children, certainly to nurse their children. I mean, we're talking about really horrific, disgusting stuff. And anyone who supports it should be ostracized and dealt with. Like, it's just very bad. And
I agree with all that.
I do have daughters. And so I think about this a lot. Like, I want them to, and it's hard to be a woman sometimes. I know it's hard to be a man sometimes, but my parents did a wonderful job of creating in my siblings and me an understanding that our sex was a gift from God, and that it did incur different responsibilities or like limitations and opportunities also, and that these were good things. And it does require a lot of work from adults to teach a healthy attitude about sex. And we are doing exactly the opposite. By the way, including that it's sex and not gender. As my Latin teacher said, people have sex, words have gender. And we always laughed because it had like a double meaning, but people have sex, words have gender.
Now, people familiar with my outlook on deities might find it weird for me to that I'm going to say this, but I think a lot of this is a function of just traditional faith decline in this country. And I don't mean in the sense that, oh, if I were religious, you know, I wouldn't believe these things, but that there is a new religion, and these kind of idiotic positions and odious things are kind of pulled into a culture war. And then the people who are on one side of it believe that they have to defend every kind of, anything that, you know, anything that these people come up with, they have to defend it as part of a sort of their cultural menu of things that are defended. It went from like, oh, you can be a boy, to we can manipulate children. And that, you know, it's almost like a religious, a right or something that they defend.
I do wonder if it's disgusting. If it's not the natural end of feminism, though, I think if feminism, like, I hate when you read those coffee mugs, it's like, feminism is the radical belief that women are people too. No, it's not. We always knew women were people. Feminism is frequently about a belief that one's body should not have too much say in who they are, or that like technology can control the body. And so really you can do a big line or demarcation in the women's rights movement, whatever you think about the larger movement, with the advent of technological interruption of fertility cycles, and how once this kind of becomes like an accepted norm about how your body doesn't matter that much for who you might be or what your roles and responsibilities will be, then it's not that far of a road to the point where we are now, I think.
There's such a weird conflict in progressivism where everything's identitarian. You know, if you're a black, that says everything about you, what you think, how you should act. But yet on the other hand, you can just change who you are like that because you say so. And it just, to me, those two ideas are in complete conflict with each other. They make no sense to me. But aren't there, I don't know enough about this, but aren't there some feminists, and, you know, I've seen kind of lesbian writers and things like that, who are actually quite critical of the whole transgender thing, because it doesn't make sense in feminism to say that being a woman really doesn't mean anything biologically, right?
On that note, it's American Girl Dolls and Company that's pushing the idea that that word is meaningless.
By the way, that stuff's so expensive. Yeah.
Some of the best fighters against gender ideology and its damage are lesbian feminists. But I still think, like, you're wondering, like, how do we get to this place where we are? And I do think this idea that your body is a problem to be conquered through outside intervention can lead to very bad, you know, it's bad to begin with, actually, but it can lead to very bad places as well.
It's just weird. Just weird to me. You have these immutable characteristics. They mean everything. You're white, so, you know, whatever, you're bad. But then you can just change.
Also interesting to me, and I say I have the radical position. I was just telling my daughter about this. Like, I don't believe in race. I do believe race is a social construct. I understand that there are biological distinctions between different groups of people, but I believe in the human race. And I'm not, I think it's like, once you try to start defining what different races mean, it's kind of like a weird, weird things happen. You know, you can have like a distinction based on skin color that actually doesn't work because some, you know, supposedly black people have a lighter skin color than some supposedly white people or whatever. I don't mean that. Anyway, I've got really weird thoughts on that. But
very
sex,
John Lennon of you. Yeah.
But sex is, you know, that's a real thing and it's not a social construct. So of course our society does exactly the opposite thing of acting like you just said that, you know, if you're black, which is sort of like however they're defining that, and that means everything and there's no escape from this like system of oppression or victimhood or whatever, and then if you're a female that doesn't mean anything at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, I believe race is a real thing. I just don't believe that it defines you in the way that our politics say. Yeah, no, it's okay. It's nice. It sounds nice. Like I said, it's very John Lennon, very Imagine.
That, dear listener, is David Harsanyi insulting me, and it's okay. We will deal with it later. Okay, so have you to take it into lighter fare, have you been watching or listening to anything recently?
Not a ton, but I did watch the end of Andor, which is on Disney Plus. I still have Disney Plus. It's part of a package I have, and it's a Star Wars series, but it is really well made. It's done by Tony Gilroy, I think it is, who has done some bigger movies. It's just really well done. Had a lot of good acting. It's like a heist movie, then it's a jailbreak movie series, and it was pretty good. I watched a terrible show, but I was addicted to it, called Snack Versus Chef. Have you heard of this?
No.
It is, so they bring a bunch of top chefs, they say, and they have a vending machine, and they randomly pick something like Cheetos or a Kit Kat. And the chefs have to try to recreate it in a competition.
Okay.
So
and you liked
that.
It.
That's that. Yeah.
Okay.
And
well,
I mentioned Graham Norton. Yeah. How about yourself?
I do want to check out the Graham Norton thing, actually. So I think last week I recommended Pennyworth or something like that.
Yeah.
And
I
was going to say, I already soured on it. So I watched it. Yeah, so I'm out. I don't even know why. I just found it like it didn't move at the clip I needed it to. And I've replaced it with The Offer. Did you see that?
Remind me. It sounds familiar, but
Paramount
I'm not
sure. Plus show about the making of The Godfather.
Okay, so no, I don't have Paramount Plus. But I read the book that the show is based on. It's called Leave the Cannolis or something, I think, like that. Okay. And it was a fantastic book. What do you think of the show?
I'm liking it thus far. I think the guy who plays Robert Evans is amazing. Clearly, it was written by the producer, so he's like the hero of the story in a way I find a little bit annoying, but he's played by Miles Teller. So I'm liking it. And then the girl who... this is like... movie reviews with old people. I don't know her name. She's in that show Ted Lasso.
She's the owner.
She's not the owner. She's the girlfriend of the star. Okay. She's in this Paramount Plus thing, The Offer, and she plays the same exact character, but like an American secretary.
Juno Temple, is that the actress, you think?
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I've never known it. So I do like her, and I like the character. It's just weird to see the same character, but like put into a complete same approach to everything, put into a completely different role, but she does it well. And then I think did I mention we were supposed to see Morrissey last week and he canceled?
Yeah.
Okay.
He canceled?
He canceled, which I guess he does all the time. But I took my daughter's class. I was the chaperone to a Bach Christmas cantata, and it was wonderful. I don't remember what number it was, so forgive me. It was like Washington, you know, they have these like lunchtime Bach concerts, and they do an organ prelude also by Bach, which was really well done. I think it was C major. And then one of the Christmas cantatas, I don't know. I was going to make up a number. But that's probably
was this like at the Kennedy Center or something like that, or
no? They do it. I'd previously been to them at the Church of the Epiphany in D.C. This one was at St. Mark's Episcopal on Capitol Hill. Okay. Nice little crowd. Really well done. I really enjoyed the performance so much, and I want to go to the next one too. And I do them, fairly regularly. It was also fun because actually I won't get into it, but Bach, Lutheran, And the Christmas Cantata was based on a hymn written by Martin Luther. So it was just deep theological meaning and just beautiful to hear it done. And then on the opposite side of the spectrum, I did my annual watching of Trapped in Paradise, which is my favorite Christmas movie. And it is...
Hold on. So this is the movie with Nicolas Cage, I think, and like John Lovitz.
Yes.
Okay, go on.
So it's hard to find because nobody would recommend it. Right. It had horrible reviews when it came out. It's John Lovitz, Dana Carvey, Nicolas Cage, and a bunch of character actors that you would love. And it got horrible reviews when it came out. Like Roger Ebert ripped it, and so did everybody else. And yet, if you go look at reviews, it's either this is the worst movie ever, or this is the most underrated Christmas movie in the history of Christmas movies. If you don't take it seriously, it is utterly delightful. It's also weird because it would be a very family friendly movie, except it begins with horrible language and it ends with horrible language. Like, it's just horrible language throughout. No sex, no nudity, no inappropriate comments related to sex or nudity, no violence, even though it's kind of like a crime drama. But the language is horrible. I find it funny, which is bad. And I do want to say I keep on getting people chastising me for my language. So I'm really working on it. But
you did let me get away with a bad word yesterday in a column. Go on.
It was a rant. It was okay.
I think it was appropriate for that moment.
It's also right? A political term.
Yeah. Thank you. I forgot to say thank you.
I think the other editors are angry still. But anyway, I love this movie, and I think it has one of the best Christmas messages. Like, there are always these movies that say the real meaning of Christmas is, you know, the joy we found along the way. That's not the real meaning of Christmas. And this show, I don't want to give too much away, but I feel like this show does a better job in telling a tale rooted in the Christmas story and its significance than most movies. So that's my recommendation.
Did you, I realize this would be more Easter related, but were you a fan of the Mel Gibson movie?
Yeah, I mean, I find it very difficult to watch, which I think is the point. We're talking about The Passion of the Christ.
Yes. I forgot what it was called.
I did think it was very well done. And I think doing art with that imagery is important. And so, yeah, I guess.
You know, there's a sequel coming out. I'm not even joking.
Okay, I thought I was like raising my eyebrows.
I'm not about to drop a line. No,
the
stuff that happens after.
Oh, great!
Probably okay. Lazarus, etc.
I love that. This is one of my beefs, and I realize you're not Christian yet, but this is one of my beefs about like liturgical art. You can get anything Christmas related. You can even get good Epiphany stuff. But there are like a dozen major Christian festivals, and it's very hard to get art to put in your house or otherwise that relates to the like you get a little bit of Easter. I actually have something here. I just pulled out my Christmas stuff. So I have my Jesus being removed from the art being put into the tomb. Like I've got some stuff, but it's like just hard to find good stuff about Pentecost or Ascension or other like big, important, meaningful transfiguration. And I want more of that. And I wish artists would make more of that.
We were in a thrift shop recently and we found one of those Jesus. It was like a painting of Jesus. And if you moved it, it would like change. Have you ever, okay. You know what I'm talking about? One of those
no,
like,
I've never
cheesy. Yeah. Yeah. If you look at it a certain angle, it's Jesus, you know, with, you know, doing something and then the other angle, Jesus doing something else, but it was a little too cheesy, I think, for us.
Okay.
I just quickly want to say Hanukkah's coming up and the complaints you have about Christmas movies and things like I have this 1,000-fold for Hanukkah, which yes. Has nothing to do with candles or lights or any of that. It is the most violent story you could ever imagine about destroying people who undermine your faith and destroying the occupier and being free. And it is amazing what they have made that holiday into in this country and elsewhere, frankly.
It's an anti-syncretist first commandment kind of holy day, but it's also not a major holy day in Judaism.
No, it's
and
not
yet
even
it's
canon.
Where It's where most of the commercialization of like a Jewish festival would be. And so it is kind of, yeah, it's
yeah, no, weird. No Greek centered story is canon in the Jewish religion. So it is not, even though it is, I believe in Catholicism for sure. I don't know how it works without the other lesser Christian faiths. Like I'm defending Catholicism because of my wife.
I All do right. want to, can I mention two other really lame things?
Yeah, of course. That's why we're here for your lame suggestions.
So I have a really good friend who lives out of state, and she came and spent the weekend with me because we had some, she has like, she works in a similar space. And so she had to come to a holiday party, a Christmas party out in DC. So she stayed with me for the weekend. So we watched Trapped in Paradise. Then we watched Ticket to Paradise, which is a George Clooney, Julia Roberts movie that just came out, which I,
oh yeah.
Mark says it was based solely on a desire of those two actors to just spend like half the year in Bali, because that's where it takes place. And it's not very good at all. I'll just say that. And then speaking of not good, we came home from a party that one of my Fox colleagues threw, and we watched the new Lindsay Lohan movie. And it was terrible.
Is it a Christmas movie or something?
Truly terrible. Yeah. But like, you, if you know that going in, I guess it's okay.
Did you think it wasn't going to be a terrible movie? I mean, I'm sure that the expectations were it would be fun because it was so bad. No,
I
guess not.
I don't know why I wanted it to be better. I'm always rooting for Lindsay. She's looking.
Have I seen her in anything? What was she in that I would have seen her in?
Mean Girls.
Parent Trap. I did see The Parent Trap. I only watched the original.
And then I think it was a lot of drugs and Botox after that.
Okay. I'm rooting for her too. I root for almost everyone. Though so you do that. That's a pretty good slate of suggestions. I need to watch more movies. I'm gonna watch, there's a movie, gosh, Bullet Train, I think it's called. With
yeah.
Brad Pitt, and it's on Netflix. So I'm gonna watch that. I'll have a report on that next week.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's important. All right. Anything else?
No. I just want to say, from Bach to Lindsay Lohan, we have covered.
Quick last thing before we go. Did you know that I've lost 10 pounds in 3.5 weeks?
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
You always look good, David. So I did not notice that.
So I was really getting up there. Yeah. So I started not eating. I had tweeted something about I eat these seaweed snacks that are 5 calories each, and I try to keep my calories low, and I use this app, and it's incredibly helpful. So I'm getting to my
may I ask what the app is?
I think it's called like just a skull. No, it's right here. Lose It. It's called Lose It with an
exclamation. And so you put in like what you're eating, and it tells you whether you're at your caloric ideal.
Yeah. So you say how much you want to lose, and you give them a timeline on how quickly you want to lose it. And they'll tell you the calorie ceiling for you for daily. Right.
Uh-huh.
If you exercise, you put it in, and it'll take those calories, reinstate more calories. And and I've been doing that. I don't know what I'm telling you. I just share everything basically.
So I actually
with people.
Something I find interesting about exercise is it's not a great way to lose weight for most people.
Very surprising,
unless you're doing weightlifting. But it is very important for your mental health, I think, to get out and work out or run or walk or hike.
Yeah, I find like running super boring, and I used to do it. I cannot. So what I do instead is I try to mix in things like play a little basketball, ride a bike, try to do different activities that keep me moving in my old age. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been working okay. We'll see. Because I did go to the doctor recently for my first checkup in a decade. Mm-hmm. And this guy calls me right before Thanksgiving and just leaves a message that says, my blood work, everything looks good, except your cholesterol is a little high. All right. Have a great Thanksgiving. And then he leaves, and then I can't get in touch with him. I'm like, what does this mean? Does this mean that, like, do we need to do anything? I don't know. So anyway, I decided
I feel like
to lose
if
weight.
If it were so that. High that you were about to die, that it would have not been left in a voicemail that way.
Yeah. But you haven't met this doctor, so you don't know that for sure. I have. I don't know exactly what his deal is. But anyway, that's it. I have nothing else.
Great. Well, lovely talking to you.
You too. Be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.